Okay, perhaps that will do for our basic presentation. And now we could take some questions.
Thank you, Bhikkhu Bodhi, for your wonderful presentation. Could I ask you, of all the many hundreds of translations you've done, which is the one that most delights you? Which is the one that you would recommend for those in sorrow and grief to comfort them? And for those with anger, which is the sutta or the passage you would ask us to turn to?
Actually, there are, it seems, three questions there.
Yes.
Yeah, the one that most delighted me, I don't know. It's not the case that I choose like one whole collection over others, but sometimes there are individual suttas that I like. Others, especially, you know, if you've tried to read whole Nikayas, there's a lot of repetition. So when I've come through like one version of the sutta, when there are different variations on it, of course, you know, it's not so interesting. But one has to translate in order to make the collection complete. Like in, for example, the Samyutta Nikaya, I think we see this in the Anapana Samyutta, some of the other Samyuttas. First, the Buddha will speak a sutta to Ananda, and then the next sutta, he states the same sutta to bhikkhus, to the monks in general. So in that case, you know, when you come to it the second time, not so interesting. So which delights me most? That I don't know, because each one has its own, say, each collection has its own point of interest. But maybe the one that I like the best of all that I've done, and it's not the one that I recommend for beginners, maybe I liked it because it was challenging and also extremely profound. It's the last chapter in the Sutta Nipata called the Parayanavaga, the way to the beyond. And then the background story to that is that there are 16 Brahmin ascetics who have traveled, they've heard about the Buddha, they've heard about the Buddha, and they've been living in South India, maybe in the state now corresponds to Karnataka state. And so they travel all the ways over a long distance to come to North India to see the Buddha. And then each one asks the Buddha some extremely deep and difficult questions in verse, and then the Buddha responds in verses. So it's very beautiful, profound and uplifting, but I don't recommend it for relative beginners. Okay, for those who are afflicted with sorrow, there's actually a sutta that occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think it's a book of fives. Maybe it's sutta number 49 or 50, but I'm not exactly sure. It's called Extracting the Dart of Sorrow. So in that sutta, I think the Buddha might be speaking to King Pasenadi, who has lost his beloved wife, or to another king. Actually, there comes a variation on that sutta where the Buddha is speaking to, a monk is speaking to another king who has lost his beloved wife, and he refuses to accept the fact that his wife has died, so he's preserving her body in a kind of oil and spending all of his days just sitting together with his wife in this casket filled with oil. And then his advisor brings the monk to see the king, and the monk speaks. The sutta was originally spoken by the Buddha, but the monk repeats it. It's on removing the dart of sorrow. So you can look, if you're interested, in the Anguttara Nikaya Book of Fives. It's somewhere in the 40s, like 49 or 50, something like that. Okay, then you also mentioned for dealing with anger. Then there's a group of suttas, again in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha. I think it's also the chapter of fives. There are several suttas, two suttas back to back, one spoken by the Buddha and one spoken by Sariputta, which give five, each one gives five different methods for dealing with aversion and or resentment. I'm just trying to think if there's a collection. Usually there, you could even find on the internet collections of suttas that deal with how to overcome anger and aversion. So you don't have to go through a big volume of 1,400 pages to find those suttas. Okay, I saw a hand someplace in the back. Okay, right here. Yes.
Okay. It's about a phrase in the Satipatthana Sutta.
It's which sutta?
Satipatthana Sutta.
Satipatthana Sutta.
Please kindly correct me if I'm wrong. It says, Parimukhang Satin Upattapetva.
Yeah.
Some monks translate it as saying that it means that you have to establish your mindfulness at the tip of your nose or yeah. the upper lips, in the upper lips area.
Yeah.
But some say it's establishing your mindfulness in front of you.
Yeah.
Could you kindly tell us what your opinion on that is?
Okay. So the expression here, it occurs in the instructions on Anapanasati in the Satipatthana Sutta and then the Anapanasati Sutta. Parimukhang Sating Upatapetva. Okay, now Parimukhang means literally mukha, means face or mouth. And pari often is a prefix, often suggesting around. So literally it would be around the face or around the mouth. And so the commentaries explain that in developing mindfulness of breathing, one should focus the attention around, at the nostrils, around the nostrils, or just on the upper lip beneath the nostrils. And that's a very literal understanding of the expression parimukhang. But I've come across passages where that expression parimukhang sating upatapetva is used apparently in a context not related to mindfulness of breathing. So I understand it simply as an idiomatic expression, meaning that when one is sitting for meditation, one sits down, first it says one bends the legs crosswise, straightens the body, and then sets up mindfulness in front of one. So it might be taken to mean simply setting up mindfulness. It might not literally mean that one sets up mindfulness around the nostrils. But also what I've found myself in the practice of Anapanasati, if one is going to practice for the purpose of gaining deeper concentration, I found that my mind naturally, even without deliberate effort, goes to this area. Okay, now some people say that because a method of meditation has become popular, of following the rising and falling of the abdomen that occurs with the breathing, or the expansion and contraction of the chest, some people say that isn't mindfulness of breathing. And that's actually correct. It is not actually mindfulness of breathing, but it doesn't mean that it's a wrong method of meditation. Because the teachers of that method say this is not mindfulness of breathing, but it is an object of mindfulness that is, you could say, conditioned by the breath. And what they say is that this is the object here, the rising, the motion of rising and falling or expansion and contraction is motion. And so it's a manifestation of the air element or wind element. So they say that this is the observation of the wind element. I don't know if that's really the observation of the wind element, but what I would say is that it's simply the awareness of a bodily element, of a bodily factor, which can serve as the basis for developing deeper, stronger mindfulness, clear comprehension, and concentration. So it doesn't matter here whether the attention is at the nostrils or at the abdomen. Of course, with that method, one is not aiming to use the object to gain the one-pointed focus of jhanas, but to develop enough concentration for insight to arise. Okay, I see one hand here, I think the third row, and then another hand back, it looks like about the fifth or sixth row.
Hello, Bhante. Okay. Thank you very much for the talk. I just wondered if you had an opinion about the secular mindfulness courses that you mentioned and in relation to the sort of mindfulness from the suttas. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, now, as probably most of you know, the mindfulness is being used in a great number of secular contexts which are not part of, we call it, the Buddhist program of liberation. What I would say is that as long as the application of mindfulness is being used in a way that's truly beneficial to people, then I think it's a good thing. I have no objection to it. I don't think mindfulness has to be used exclusively within the framework of the Buddha's teaching in order to, you know, to gain to gain liberation from the cycle of repeated birth and death. For example, there's something called mindfulness-based stress reduction that was developed by an American, John Kabat-Zinn, for use with patients in hospitals who have chronic pain conditions, health conditions, or psychological stress. And so the use of practice, it's been found that practices of mindfulness help people deal with their chronic pain, with illnesses, and with stress. Now, mindfulness is used in, I think it's been integrated into certain methods of psychotherapy to help people maybe see more clearly and deeply into their mentally distressed conditions in order to lay bare the function of their mind in order to improve their psychological condition. And then I know in schools, mindfulness is being used in the in certain educational systems to help students become more calmer in the school, more concentrated, to establish more harmonious relations between students. In fact, a friend of mine, a Sri Lankan monk, Venerable Dhammajiva, he's given a lecture here, he's developed in Sri Lanka, a program is called Satipasala, Mindful Schools, teaching. It's used with school children from the different religions, even with the support of their own clergy, whether they're Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Muslim. They're all learning this mindfulness simply, to be aware of the breath, to do the mindful walking, playing mindful games, and it's helping. Yeah, maybe it's another story when mindfulness is used by corporations, say, to make their workers more docile, less likely to complain about oppressive working conditions, having to walk longer hours. So you have to work this weekend. Oh, no. You can work mindfully.
Thank you, Venerable Sir. My question relates exactly to that last statement that you made. Because mindfulness tends, you've talked about the three factors.
Yeah.
But there is also, isn't it an important factor that you need to bring in mindfulness for what?
Mindfulness.
For what? Sila, or sense of service.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the books that I often read very regularly is your book on the Buddha's teachings on communal harmony, where the Buddha talks about welfare for oneself and welfare for the community. Shouldn't there be an ethical sense of concern and work for the welfare of the community as well as liberating oneself?
First, if that question is intending to pertain to the use of mindfulness, say, in these secular contexts, I believe that within some of the secular contexts that I've mentioned, even though the Buddhist ethical code, say, of five precepts is not specifically stipulated, But it's expected that those who are undergoing this training in mindfulness as a method of stress reduction, pain management, or psychotherapy will be adhering at least to a basic ethical way of life. Okay. And also in the schools, I believe, when mindfulness is taught in the educational systems, also basic ethical observances are taught. But the way you phrase it, shouldn't mindfulness be taught, how did you express it, for the purpose of promoting the well-being of the community and for gaining liberation along the Buddha's path? Okay, I would say that's a Buddhist, or at least for gaining the goal of the Buddhist path, that's certainly a Buddhist application of mindfulness. One could use mindfulness for promoting the well-being of the community in order to, well, to help regulate one's own defilements and to understand other people better without necessarily having the Buddha's framework in mind. Maybe for a Buddhist practitioner working in a Buddhist community, that would be the aim. But say a person, a non-Buddhist, who's doing, say, community, what do they call this, community welfare work, can use mindfulness and some of the auxiliary practices like developing loving kindness and compassion to be able to help the community. But since they're not Buddhist and the people in the community are not Buddhist, they're not necessarily doing this to gain the liberation that comes at the end of the Buddhist path.
Hello, Bhante. I love the idea of mindfulness as being like a microscope under which we can observe the mental states. And maybe I'm sort of tangling up my understanding of the analogy, and I know analogies are quite limited, but how can the mind observe itself? You know, like if something is constantly changing as the mind is, how can something that's constantly changing observe itself as it constantly changes? It seems paradoxical.
How can the mind observe itself?
If it's constantly changing, it's like, how can an eye see itself? It would.
Yeah, that's a good question. We're all talking about mindfulness, but I see we have a practitioner right here. Okay, how can the mind actually observe itself? In theory, I don't know how, but it can. I'll give you a little experiment to do right now. Everybody can do this. Okay, you're seated, close the eyes. Now just let the word mind arise. Just let the thought, the word mind, arise in your mind. And watch the word mind as it arises. Just you keep on mentally repeating the word mind, mind, mind. Okay, and as you're mentally repeating that word, you're simultaneously watching the mind. You're able to see what happens as the word mind comes up on each occasion. And we do the same thing with any thought that arises, but usually what happens in our day-to-day life, we tend to work or to function a little bit like zombies, you know, without self-awareness. And so what mindfulness of the mind does is to make the content of the mind to light, to expose it to the light of awareness. And what I found to be actually to be a useful practice in doing the formal sitting meditation, after one gains some degree of the mind settles down to some extent, is to use that practice of just focusing on the word mind and going on observing the word mind. And one will see, after a minute, 30 seconds, 15 seconds, that one loses the word mind, and the mind is wandering. And then one has to remember, bring the mind, the word mind back, to collect one's mind again, and come back to the mind. But as one sees the mind wandering, one notes the kind of thought that has arisen, and in that way, one is mindful of the mind, or mindful of the content of the mind. Maybe one could say that there's a subtle distinction between the observational, the mind in its observational aspect, and the mind as the observed content. And so the observational aspect of the mind is observing the content of the mind. Maybe that distinction helps. Okay, maybe we could take one more question, then I think we'll have to end for the evening. Did we take any questions on this side?
Thank you, Bhante. Just related to the previous question, I thought the Satipatthana actually itself gives the answer, because you know, every foundation, you have the ajhattam vakai, bahiddha vakai, and ajhatta bahiddha vakai means actually the arising of that consciousness. I just wanted to.
What he's referring to in the Satipatthana Sutta, it makes a distinction of ajhatang and bahida. So that's internal and external. So one dwells ajhatang kaye kaino pasi viharati. One dwells contemplating. Well, that actually is not really indicating necessarily the observation of the mind, but it's ajhatang means in relation to oneself. And then the opposite is bahida, externally. So in relation to the cittanupassana, then it's ajhatang citta cittanupassi viharati. So internally, one dwells contemplating the mind in the mind. So that's what's said in the Satipatthana Sutta. But the actual, let us say, the philosophical basis for that is not set out in the sutta. But I would say the philosophical basis is this recognition of two aspects to the mind, what I call the observational aspect and the observed aspect, the content of the mind.
I have a question, slightly abstract question, really, about the nature of Bhavanga and how that gives us access to various levels of awareness.
How that gives us access to?
Levels of awareness.
Yeah.
And maybe sort of a link between one life and the next.
Yeah, this is a theoretical question relating to the Abhidhamma. There are actually numbers of philosophical difficulties connected with the notion of the Bhavanga, I have to say. And to explore them here... Yeah, no, I won't try to do that. But let's just say that there is a factor that, of course, connects the mind from one life to the other. Whether the Bhavanga can perform that function successfully, I don't know. I actually find the notion a bit problematic. I mean, there is some deep level of consciousness that remains in a flow going on from life to life. And that, I think the problem with the Bhavanga is that it has its own object and its own constellation of mental factors, but it's never said in the Abhidhamma text that the Bhavanga is what preserves, say, the karmic accumulations and the character traits from life to life. And it seems that there's needed some aspect of consciousness that has that function, that preserves the karmic formations and that preserves the habitual tendencies and that preserves the underlying defilements. But the Bhavanga, when you look at it analytically, doesn't have those functions. And so this is where I find the notion of Bhavanga a bit problematic. I'm not hearing the question, sir. If you have the microphone. Yeah, but the thing is, you see, according to the Abhidhamma, when we have the full conscious awareness, the Bhavanga is not occurring.
Yes.
And when the Bhavanga is occurring, at those moments, we don't have the full conscious awareness. So say, according to the Abhidhamma, like even while we're speaking here, countless times the mind is dropping into the Bhavanga, coming out, dropping in, coming out. But at the moment that it's in Bhavanga, one doesn't have the full conscious awareness.
Yes.
And when we're in full conscious awareness, we're not accessing the Bhavanga.
The way I'm thinking, a simile is like being like a radio.
Yeah.
It's got different wavelengths, different frequencies.
Yeah.
And the Bhavanga is like the resting place for some level of awareness that can be the baseline for some activity to occur from.
Yeah.
And it can be from different levels that this consciousness arises at a high level or at a low level.
Yeah.
As to how you tuned into your...
Yeah. Could be, yeah. Maybe you should write at least an article.
maybe I should.
Yeah.
When I think of my PhD, Nick.
Okay, I think we'll have to bring the function to an end, because tomorrow I have to fly.
But the last question.
Yeah.
You know, Ekai no Bhikkhave Ayam Maggo. This word has been translated in different ways by different scholars.
Yeah.
This is the direct path, this is the only path, etc. My simple question is, which translation would you prefer on these translations?
Okay, first let me explain the expression. Earlier translators used to translate it as this is the sole way, this is the only way, this is the only path. And I think I have to say that it was translators working in Sri Lanka who did this during the colonial period when Buddhism was under pressure from the Christian missions, who were saying, Christianity or Christ is the only way. So they found the statement in the Satipatthana Sutta and said, we have our only way, Satipatthana. But the expression used is Ekaya no Maggo. Okay, Maggo is path. What's a bit problematic is Ekaya no. If the text wanted to say this is the only way, it would have said Ekova Maggo. Eko is one or only. The V is emphatic, just giving some emphasis. But it's Ekaya no. So I search for this word using these global search functions to see if it occurs any place else in the suttas outside the context of Satipatthana. And I found, I think even Venerable Nyanamoli found this earlier, a passage, it's in the Mahasaya Nada Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta number 12, where the text is giving a simile to illustrate how somebody who's acting in a certain way is heading to rebirth in a particular realm. And it gives, for example, the simile of a person who's walking straight to a pit of hot coals, like he's going to fall into that pit of hot coals. And it says that he's walking along an Ekaya no Maggo towards that pit of coals. So it doesn't mean that is the only path to the pit of coals, but it's a path which is going straight to that pit of coals. And so I take Ekaya no to be a one-way path, and I would take it in conjunction with following that expression. We have a series of data, in Pali grammar these are called datives. That is a particular case indicating one of the uses is to show a purpose or a goal. And so this is Ekaya no Maggo. How does it go? Sattanang visuddhiya, sokapari devanang atangamaya, sokapari devanang samatikamaya, dukkadomanasanang atangamaya. Nayasa adigamaya nibbanasa sachikiriyaya. So those are datives in the, and I would take them together with that expression, the one-way path, So this is the one-way path for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and suffering, for the passing away of pain and grief, for the achievement of the right way, for the realization of Nibbana. So it's a one-way path, a path that goes in this one direction. It doesn't mean it's the only path.